Welcome to episode 114 of the Block Podcast. I'm Marsha Links Quayle in Rabat, Morocco. I'm joined, as always, by Ursula Lindsay, who's in Amman, Jordan. And our guest today is Jonas Al-Busti, who's going to talk with us about the larger-than-life Moroccan novelist Mohamed Choukri. Welcome, Jonas. It's good to finally have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. Jonas is a writer, translator, and professor of Arabic at Yale University. He is inarguably one of the most dedicated and active scholars focusing on the work of Mohamed Choukri today. Choukri himself is probably best known for his autobiographical novel For Bread Alone, El Khobz El Hafi, which is an unsparing account of growing up poor and illiterate on the streets of colonial Tangier. But Choukri wrote all his life. He wrote much more besides that. And a lot of it is available in English today, thanks to Jonas Al-Busti, who has translated Choukri's short story collection, Tales of Tangier. The third installment of Choukri's autobiography, Faces, and who has also edited with Roger Allen a critical anthology entitled Reading Mohamed Choukri's Narratives. So we are delighted to have you here with us today to talk about this talented, troubled, utterly fascinating writer.
Thank you so much for having me. I just want to say thank you for the amazing work you've been doing for so many years, Boulaq and Arabic Lit. I'm a huge fan of both of you, and I'm really thankful and grateful to the amazing work you've been doing.
Thank you so much. You don't need to say that, but thanks very, very much. Thanks. Please tell us about Mohamed Choukri. Introduce him to our listeners for those who don't know him or don't know that much about him.
So I'll just start by giving a biography of Mohamed Choukri and maybe talk a little bit about his work. But Mohamed Choukri was born in Etchigar, a village in the reef, not far from the city of Nador, in the reef region in Morocco in 1935. And around in the 1940s, there was a famine in Morocco and hunger, and his family and others really in that region were obliged to migrate and leave Nador and other close by villages to cities like Tetouan and Tangier. So Mohamed Choukri and his family were forced to leave that region to go to the city of Tangier by Tetouan. And this character, Mohamed Choukri, had a very rough, really, life characterized by poverty, malnutrition, and anything you really think of. His family moved to Tangier, and as they say, always way back to Tetouan, because also the family lived in Tetouan. And in fact, his brother, Reynaud, lives in Tetouan. And we'll probably go to talk about this when we discuss like his family. And at a young age, he actually left his family. And that's really due to his father's abuse, really, and violence. And all of this is described, and you see it in Khobz al-Hafi, translated by Paul Bowles, For Bread Alone. And Mohamed Choukri, throughout like his teens, lived in Tangier, and he practiced whatever one would imagine, like theft, you know, prostitution, going to the brothel, violence, eating from garbage, all different, like really, like it's this really harsh life. And you could really see it, this unflinching descriptions of sex, violence, drug, and all that stuff you could see actually in Al Khobz Al Hafi, his first installment of his autobiography. Mohamed Choukri, I mean, there's really this sort of like important point where, which is the end really of Khobz Al Hafi, when he, you know, first time, you know, in the prison cell. And again, it's not, you know, for a short amount of time. He was introduced to the lines of Abul Qasim Shabi, the Tunisian poet. And this has, or this marked really a huge change transformation for Choukri, wanting to learn really how to read and write. Choukri went to the city of Al-Araish, Larish, started at the age when he was 20 to read and write. going through the training to be a teacher. And he literally, his first career was a school teacher in the city of Tangier. And from an early age, just to say, the Shukri wanted really to be a writer. And he's the second installment, Zamal Akhta, Streetwise. He narrates or tell us about that incident of him becoming a writer. When it comes to probably his overall, just to say a little bit, and because I know we're going to probably discuss most of this stuff, Shukri has wrote a lot of things. One of the probably well-known is Al-Khubz Al-Hafi for Bread Alone. The second installment is Zaman Al-Akhta Streetwise. The third one, Wujuh Faces. He also wrote a collection of short stories, which is Majnun Al-Warad and Al-Khayma. The two collections that I translated in a book named Tales of Tangier that was published by Yale University Press. Shukri also had his Zouk al-Chiko, Souq al-Dakhili, which will be forthcoming from Georgetown University Press in fall 2026. And he wrote only one play, but though through a lot of things, there are other plays that were published in Al-Alam newspaper that I'm still looking for myself. But what we have is Wayf al-Sa'ada, Happiness. There is a book of literary criticism, Riwayat Shurur al-Abyad, The Temptation of the White Sparrow. And also the books he wrote in Tennessee, Williams, Jean Genet, and Paul Bowles. Lived most of his life in Tangier and died in Tangier in November of 2023.
So would it be fair to say that in a way his great main subject in some sense was the city of Tangier or the people who lived in Tangier, that that's what most of his stories treat in one way or another?
That's actually a really great question, Ursula. I mean, one of the things really with Shukri, and he, I'll just say probably this the sort of a preface to the question, he has really this obsession with Tangier. And Tangier, for him, he has a very complicated nature with Tangier. When you ask, you know, like, you know, Mohammed Shukri, like through a lot of interviews to speak about Tangier. So Tangier to him really meant a lot. And I think you do a great sort of job in your piece in the New York Review of Books, talking of this aromantic Tangier. It's a really complicated relationship, and it's that hard to sort of reduce to a few words, you know. And by that, we'll go to Tangier being really sort of the center for all his writing. And most of the characters are coming from Tangier. I mean, if you look, for instance, just give you one simple example of Wujuh are all these characters that he met in Tangier, and he would dedicate each chapter to one specific person. And also, if you look at the, for instance, you look at either Majnun al-Warad or the Khayma, you also see all these characters in Tangier. So you have the space of Tangier. You have all places like, you know, Zouk al-Chiko. You have all different places in Tangier, all different neighborhoods in the old city. If you go back, you know, in terms of faces, in terms of Zouk al-Chiko as well as sort of Souq al-Dakhili, sort of the title of his novel, it's all the characters are coming from Tangier. All these characters are, you know, characters who are coming from the underbelly of society, really people that are, you know, poor, living in impoverished poverty, and they're really struggling to make ends meet. So these are all like sort of characters coming from there. So if you read Shukri's work, you really as you're questioning, like as you mentioned in your question, it's about Tangier. It's about the city of Tangier as the space where all these events, all these descriptions, all this action take place.
So in your introduction to the anthology reading Mohammed Shukri's narratives, you have this beautiful description of his short stories as a juxtaposition of the misery of life with the bliss of imagination, which I really liked. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the sort of unique characteristics of his style, what makes it so compelling stylistically over the course of his oeuvre?
That's great. That's a great question, Masha. I mean, one of the really thing that I love, I mean, I would just say to you that before translating the Tales of Tangier or Majnun Warad Al-Khayma, I've read them over extensive period of time. And I really fall in love with the short stories for multiple reasons. One of it is the fact that when you'd seen Shukri, you see this sort of unflinching depictions of things. But the way that things are really described are very terse, It's a direct language. It's not flowery. And which is kind of rarely seen sometimes in the Persian sort of Arabic literature. His prose is terse, minimalist, stark, reflecting the brutal life of poverty, addiction, sexual experience he endured. And one thing that I love, you know, as you mentioned now, in terms of like, you know, these short stories, is the fact they're so different. And in fact, I've had a lot of conversation with so many of my colleagues, but also Roger Allen's introduction. He's like, probably this is what we call short narratives, because they don't follow sort of short stories as sort of the standard. Because it really, what you find in all these like tales or all these like short narratives, there's really sort of no beginning. You're just like sort of like thrown in the middle of an action in the stories. And I think this is sort of unique, really. You really go and you are like in the middle of an action without sort of any introductions, which is so different than work of other short story writers. I mean, we can probably think of Edgar Allan Poe. We don't really have to go further. We can think of Yusuf Idris. We can think of Zakaria Tamir and others. So it's really sort of unique. I think his style, and if I can just give one specific example, I always like to talk about this, which is Violence on the Shore, which was the first short story of Mohammed Shoukry to be published in the Adab magazine. And just to talk a bit about it, so when Mohammed Shoukry sent this to Adab magazine, which is a Beiruti literary magazine, directed and edited and by Suhail Idris. Suhail Idris was so in love with this piece because it's so different than anything. And you know, at that certain stage, like, this is a piece of literature not sanitized. It's so different. It's very daring, right? To talk about like this character and you have this sexual depiction or scene in the beach. So it was so different. But also what really makes this sort of a story also unique is Shoukry depicting this character, but also talking with sort of like what I would call like precision about this character, give us this depiction of Maymoun, who is Maymoun. Also Maymoun being a person who is rejected from society, because as you probably like remember that story from Violence on the Shore, Maymoun is being described as mentally deranged. Nobody wanted to converse with him. Nobody wanted to deal with him except the narrator. So what one of the things I really like about this is this sort of minimalist approach, terse language, the economy of language as well of his prose. It makes it really, as far as I'm concerned, really beautiful and appealing and really great piece of literature.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because he was so committed to becoming a writer and to developing as a writer. But on the other hand, when I read his short stories, I see someone who is utterly unconcerned with what the rules of short stories are, right? Absolutely. There's a kind of a universal, like, you must have a beginning, rising action, correct, climax, falling action, etc. But he seems to, like, take this rule book and hurl it out the window, and he's going to become a writer, and he's going to write these short stories, but in his own way.
Well, I think what makes him such a fascinating, I mean, that's part of the fascination of him as a writer and as a person, and because of so much of his writing is autobiographical, the two sort of overlap, but that he was really a sort of outsider, that he had this real experience of like marginalization, and that he like insisted on portraying that there's something incredibly moving about his first book and reading this book of somebody where it ends with the decision. You're reading a whole story on the part of someone who was illiterate when it was happening to them. And then there's this, you know, final revelation of like how he even became the writer who could put this book into your hands. And the moments like that, that are sort of like the little moments of like real powerful redemption or hope, or in this sea of often like really like harsh reality that he refuses to compromise on showing you at all, are extra sort of moving and touching for it, because they're so kind of rare. And yeah, I mean, like what I kept thinking about when I wrote about him is like, when you compare him to other writers of his generation, like there just are so few writers that come from that kind of a reality, that can really describe it, that aren't describing it at a distance and sociologically and politically and whatever. I mean, most writers are middle-class people. Like, he really had a different background, and it shows. And then he didn't try to clean himself up. Like, he really insisted on a kind of not.
You know, it's really unique. And I mean, this is a really great thing that you've mentioned. I think it's brilliant, because you have a lot of people are sort of not firsthand experience they're writing about. And you really see this when he is sort of being critical in his own literary criticism of Riwayat Shorl Abiyad, The Temptation of White Sparrow, because as exactly as you've mentioned, this is firsthand experience. He's writing about things that he actually endured himself. When we're talking about all this poverty, we're talking about all this really harsh life. I mean, he has all the tools. He has all the tools to write, to sit down and write about this experience. When we think about his, and this is something really that I often kind of like think about, it's not in a puzzling way, but also like you're thinking about 18, 20 something years of what he endured. And once he acquired the tools of writing, which is here modern and Arabic. And of course, Shukri is well known of having this sort of multilingual text, meaning by that you have modern and Arabic, you have Moroccan Arabic, then you have Tarifit, which is like the Amazigh, and then you also have Spanish being there, because he's really was, and he was an avid reader. I mean, he knew Spanish literature very well. And I can come to this to talk a little bit about it. But just coming back to the point that when Shukri was once asked, you know, that his writing is raw, he's writing about all these vulgar things, and it's one of the responses, like in many occasions, he would say, what did they want me to write about? Flowers? I'm writing about this sort of like depiction of really this hard life. And I think this is really important, because there is no, as I said earlier, no flowery surf language. It's this gritty realism, like really things as they, he described things as they are. And it's coming straight from his firsthand experience. Now, if we would think or surf making a surf comparison, you're absolutely right. You don't really have at that stage anyone writing in modern Arabic literature dealing with all these things. Of course, there was a moral backlash because of Shukri's depiction of all of this. We can talk about that. And that actually led to the banning of Al-Khubz al-Hafi for Brit Long. But you're absolutely right. It really comes from his experience. I mean, you have this direct experience that are being described in his own work. The underground society, Moroccans that are living on the margin, people, you know, this sort of like colonial legacies and more and more and more.
And if I can just share, I put this quote into the article, but there's a quote by Abdallah Taya about Muhammad Shukri that I think speaks to this, because not only, as you say, he was, so his books had a, you know, they had a success. They were, you know, they had an influence, they had an impact. They also had criticism when they came out, but that he continues to be quite so known and so relevant. And so the Moroccan writer Abdallah Taya, and this is my translation from a radio interview that he gave, but he has this quote where he says, Muhammad Shukri was a beggar. Muhammad Shukri experienced hunger. Muhammad Shukri experienced sex very early. Muhammad Shukri experienced prostitution. Muhammad Shukri was a thief. Muhammad Shukri was a prisoner. What Moroccan writer up to this day has as much honor as him? There's only him. He committed all these sublime crimes, if I may call them that, and he is loved. He was born in 1935, we're in 2021, and the memory of what he did is still incredibly alive and incredibly liberating. And really, I just thought that was such a nice tribute from one writer to another.
Absolutely. And I really think reading this really brings the sort of question to say he is alive. I mean, that's a really... that's something I've really done, just to say this, and a lot of sort of my interview on talking is sort of, we need sort of rereading, you know, Muhammad Shukri, because I always think of the early 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s, really, the person that always was, he was really, there was so much injustice, if I can probably use that term, and so much moral backlash of someone, like, because of his brutal honesty, you know, his brutal honesty broke all these cultural taboos and challenges the, you know, this sort of literally elite monopoly, right? You don't have, even if you think of Morocco by itself, if you're thinking of certain writers, Mohamed Choukri really comes from the underbelly of society. I mean, Mohamed Choukri, thinking of this kid that did every single thing, including really eating from garbage, right? I mean, if we go back and just think of the heavy by itself and thinking of certain things that he's bringing, this sort of did chicken hole. I mean, how many other writers, this may be just like, how many other writers really like dealt with that? I'm just putting that out there. But you really have him as a personal autodidact who really, as Marsha mentioned earlier, really want to be a writer. He wanted to write. And also there is a sort of this urgent message that he had that sort of urged him to write. And if I can just like, you know, just allude to something quickly, like in Zamal al-Akhta Streetwise, you have the a passage there when he spoke about him as a writer, and I can just like briefly like explain this scene. So Mohamed Choukri would go to this coffee shop. So this coffee shop where there is a Moroccan writer, Mohamed Sabah, and very prominent writer, and Choukri would always like come there and just sit down and observe him and seen him writing. And we, as we know this, like Choukri really loved to observe people. I mean, Jean Genet and others. And Mohamed Choukri really wanted to know who he was. And the reason why, because Mohamed Choukri in his description, this writer, he's revering him. There is so much respect. And he was like Mohamed Sabah. The next day, Mohamed Choukri come with a piece of writing, gave it to Mohamed Sabah. Mohamed Sabah took it and came back the next day, and he told Choukri, this is not bad, keep on writing. And he recommended so many books for him to read. And this is sort of the start really of his career, from that sort of encounter, for that sort of a moment that Mohamed Choukri himself, you know, realizing, hey, I can also be a writer. And he really took that upon himself to actually start writing. Prior to Violence on the Shore that we mentioned earlier, there are short pieces that were published in the Moroccan newspaper Al Alam, and this is sort of really the start. And you could see in Streetwise or Zamal al-Akhta, when he published his first piece, it was amazing. Mohamed Choukri was celebrating. He went and he bought a new clothing. I mean, that description was so funny. Like, he would like, this guy, like, I kind of quote, I mean, it's quote, but like thinking of this guy from Shantytown produced literature. I mean, this is really the start.
So there's a short story that you selected for us to read, and it's called The Poets, and I'll just launch right into it in your translation, of course. The Poets. The audience awaited the arrival of the procession of poets. There was a platform on the sidewalk of the big street, and books on a table listing the numbers of poets and a trash can. The audience was silent, all crowded together. Some people moved to the front of the and craned their necks, looking down the length of the street. More people kept crowding into the street. Their bodies merged as they clung to the edge of the sidewalk. They whispered. The procession of poets appeared, surrounded by guards. Six poets. Seven. No, eight, nine. There were nine poets. The eyes of the audience met the poet's gaze, and the poets gazed back. Look, their beards are long and their hairs thick and fluffy. No doubt they were kept imprisoned in a place where the sun could barely be seen and there was scarcely enough air to breathe. Never before had there been such an audience. Today its silence seemed solemn. The footsteps of the guards and poets were clearly heard. The audience could not believe what they were seeing. Even the children were silent, their mouths agape. A woman put her hand over her mouth, the mouth of a little girl who was sobbing silently, gently quieting her. The poets' jackets were black, numbered on front and back, the numbers big and white. Four guards ascended the wooden steps to the platform, followed by the procession of poets, and behind them the rest of the guards. The guards forced them to line up facing the audience. After a moment's silence, the chief of the guards called on poet number one. Come forward and toss your books into the trash can. The poet did not move. The guard called out a second time in a louder voice and a third time even louder. Poet number one stayed fixed in place. The guard looked threateningly at the poet and pointed at the trash can. The guard then moved to the table, snatched two books with the black stickers on them, a number one written in white, and tossed them contemptuously into the trash can. The voice of the chief of guards grew increasingly angry as he continued to call out the numbers of the poets. The guard disposing of the book spat on one before he tossed it into the trash can. The audience seethed. Children cried. Shouts of protest were heard. The guard chief whispered in the ear of the book disposer. All the poets refused. Silence anew. The eyes of the poets met the gaze of the audience, who gazed back. And thus, just as the poets had ascended the platform, they descended it again, back to the place they'd come from. And that's from Tangent, 1973. So that story is, of course, very different from some of the work that we've been talking about, which, you know, focuses on sex workers and poverty, et cetera. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this story and how it fits in his trajectory.
Thank you so much, Marsha, for the beautiful reading. I mean, I love this story, and for multiple reasons. And you see this story absolutely. It's different than Maimoun, different than Monsef, different than Aisha. And what I love about this story, the setting of the story by itself. And also, I mean, it's so beautiful in Arabic. I would say that it's so beautiful in Arabic. And one of the things in the story by itself really deals with a lot of topic, including censorship. And you would see all these poets in this sort of procession. And you have all these audiences. I love this sort of connection between the audience and the poets. And you could see through the gaze, they're looking at each other as if they're unified in one sort of mission, which I love. And here you have the poets really being called by number. The entire thing that you would see them as prisoners really coming onto the stage, and they're asked to toss their book in a garbage bin. And this story really contextualizes the time of Morocco. I always sort of refer back to the time of, the political sort of unrest, like in the 1970s, but also the political imprisonment of intellectuals. And I think it deals with the sort of indirectly the years of Lent, where people were sort of like imprisoned because of their political involvement, their opposition, to the monarchy. And we have a lot of, poets like Labi and others. And I think this is really beautiful and a direct sort of like description really of what was going on in Morocco contextually around that time. And you've also mentioned the date of the when the story was written. Very different, doesn't have what we have in other stories, the depictions, of sex, of drug, and all different other things in other stories.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's also interesting that his, For Bread Alone is a story that takes place pre-independence. Like, his childhood is the end of the colonial era. And it is justly so, like, read as a huge criticism of colonialism because, and he said this in interviews, he said, colonialism stole my childhood. I mean, other people were complicit in that theft, I think he would say also, but, he was very clear on who he made the primarily responsible for the misery of his childhood. But then what's interesting to me is that you get all his subsequent writing through the 60s and 70s and 80s, and he casts as critical, as harsh, as honest a look on the post-colonial, post-independence, situation in Tangier. And the misery that he describes in a lot of the stories is not alleviated because, again, he's dealing with a stratum of society that whose life doesn't necessarily change for the better. And again, he has, like, I think, a lot of courage in his writing, and that comes through in this story too, which is, different than the vignettes of, people carousing and fighting and just trying to make ends meet. But it has this sort of characteristic. A lot of his stories have the characteristic of, like, the individual and the crowd, or the individual in the community, the person on the street and the people around them, the poets on the stage and the audience in front of them. Like, how do they interact? Do they support each other? Do they abandon each other? Do they turn on each other? That's often, I find, a very fraught point in his stories. Yeah.
And I think that's a really good point, because if you go back to the poet, just to say a little bit more about it, and this is what I really find fascinating as well, is both serve the crowd or the audience and the poets. And the reason why I say they're one, because they're really suffering from the same, they're enduring the same, you know, tribulations they are going through. They're literally one because they are enduring all the surf injustice. And I think what's so unique in that specific one, which I love, is when he's like, when he says the eyes of the poet met the gaze of the audience who gazed back. And you have that at surf in the beginning, at the end of the of this short narrative. But also, like, even the beginning, when you say the audience awaited the arrival of the procession of poets, and you really see them as being sort of unified, and you see them as being sort of the recipient of all this sort of injustice. And again, if you really think about it, and you're thinking about 1973, and one of the things you would see in the English translation, I kept that sort of the date of the date when the stories were written, mm-hmm. which I really think, I could have easily not used what was in the Arabic, but I wanted also to leave this sort of date because it contextualized the social, political, context and atmosphere in Morocco by itself. And if you think in the 1970s, it was really years of lit. And if you think about all these poets really being numbered, being, you know, having sort of these jackets, like even when one of them would say, look, their beards are long and their hair is thick and fluffy. I think of all sort of these conditions, but also having the guards, having the footsteps of the guard, having all that, as we're like having this sort of trial in open space and asking these poets to get rid of their writing, thinking of like sort of thinking of writing as being resistance or thinking of writing as being a threat to the rule, to the ruler or like, you know, ruling elites. I think this is really... A very different that I would say than Aisha than other, but also coming back to your point, and I think, thinking of sort of local colonial legacies and how, like, thinking of all this like colonization robbed Shukri, you know, from his life in his childhood, but also sort of like post-colonial, post-independence, the fact that nothing really has changed, and this speaks really sort of to Tai'i's quote. But I also want to probably quote you as well, Ursula, from your piece.
No,
because there is a really good one that you actually wrote, which is really great, I think. And the reason why I'm saying is because you say today for bread alone is often read as post-colonial narrative in which a native son reappropriates Tangier from Orientalist and colonialist representation. This is certainly true, but Shukri's writing also is a rebuke to official Moroccan national narratives, end of quotes. I just really think this really, they're relevant because you also think of like that sort of like the colonial legacies and all that, but also this sort of like really the colonialist representation, but also how Shukri's writing really speaks, as you mentioned, like Moroccan national narratives. He's really being critical. There has not been a lot of changes, like even think of 1960s, 1980s and all that. In terms of like marginalization, in terms of like, you know, poverty, in terms of so many things, really people living on the margins. And I think this is what Shukri deals with in his writing. I think this is like for him, as I mentioned earlier, narrating the suffering of the Andrabilif society, people who really have hard time to make ends meet. And these are the the characters that Shukri has dealt with in all his over. I mean, we can take anything like Faces, Wujuh, Zamal al-Akhta, Sukh Dakhili, think of also like Khubz al-Hafi. We also like, you think of the short story collection. These are the characters that are described, that are narrated with brutal honesty, I'd say that. This is something that was really hard for a lot of people to take. I mean, you know that, Al-Khubz al-Hafi really created a scandal. It's all over the Arab world, not just being Morocco by itself, but also what happened in the American University in Cairo.
I mean, yeah, it's been banned and censored and discussed. And yes, and I just wanted to follow up on what you're saying in terms of the two sides of his. So there's a story like The Poet where he is in this, being a little bit more explicitly political, but he often isn't, or he's political through experience, through his characters, through the things he depicts. And And I just, you made me think of this, and I think it's a good example. In this same short story collection, the things that shocked people, as much as the something like the poets and the implication of like the lack of freedom, but what also shocked people about his writing was just the honesty of some of the characters. And I wanted to give this one example. There's a short story that the opening of which I think is kind of amazing. It's called Men Are Lucky. And I just think if you read the first page, you can see with the sort of electric quality of some of his writing. And again, this is a typical story of his where it just starts in the middle of a conversation. You have no idea what's going on. So it starts, "Always remember that you're a foundling," she told me. "And what about you?" I felt like asking her. "Who are you? Remember also that I rescued you from your father, who divorced your whore mother. He threatened to kick you out of the house if you didn't marry the first man who asked for your hand. People say that your mother was a whore before and after marrying your father. Today she has become a madam since your father divorced her. How can you be sure that your father is your true father? Can you prove it to me? But every time we quarreled, I was only trying to explain to her that her existence and mine were simply those of a woman and a man, her and me, about whom we would never know the whole truth, because no one is born the way they wish to be born. One is born the way others want. And when people become able to think about their own existence, they discover that they have been condemned by others to a life that they must either accept or refuse in their own way. A human being is a human being, regardless of whose son or daughter they are." "You're such an idiot," she interrupted rudely. "I'm married to an idiot. I don't understand you. You're depraved. Don't forget that you're a foundling." And then it goes on from there. They have like a violent fight. It is just the most extraordinary opening to a story. Absolutely. It's a married, and there are so many of these kinds of conversations and exchanges in his stories that are shocking in this way that's like vivifying.
But there's also this, I think, so important that is so central to a lot of his work, that people, once they recognize, they see how others have condemned them to live their life, and they must either accept or refuse. And so many of his characters refuse.
Absolutely.
Even in very self-destructive ways, that refusing means basically dying or, you know, drinking themselves to death or, you know, getting into fights or ending up in prison. But yes, yes.
I mean, one of the things really, and I'm, you know, that so kind of like you see like throughout all the tales of Tangier, or again, I mean, it's not really tales of Tangier in English. It's Majnun Ruwar and Al-Khaim. And this question comes again to, you know, Yale wanted really to say something like tales of Tangier rather than actually using the actual, you know, Al-Khaim, the tent, which we have in the middle. But you really see throughout all this sort of the characters. I mean, you think of that, you think also of the story, The Vomit, and another story talking about flies is bad. I mean, I'll address a question that you mentioned earlier about like the sort of political message. I mean, one of the things about Chokri, really through everything that you read, there is a political message there. And though it's not sort of explicit, right? He's not one of the writers who are coming and throughout his writing, he's like telling people what they need to do, what kind of search resistance. But I think through this very beautiful indirect message, it's actually there in all these stories. I mean, just to think about Men Are Lucky, which I really find really great, is just this paragraph you've read: "One born the way others want, and come back and saying, and when people become able to think about their own existence, discover that they've been condemned by others to a life they must either accept or refuse in their own way." I think this is really super philosophical. I mean, think about it. We probably can spend the entire session here just trying to sort of like analyze this specific line, what it really like means by it. I think it really speaks volumes, because the fact, even think of the line being condemned by others, or people want you to be someone else than actually you. I think you really see this. I always, kind of like don't want to say that like Shukri is the champions of the poor and use all this sort of language itself, but you really feel that through all what you are actually reading. You really feel that a character who's really suffering, either because of colonial legacies, colonialism, or sort of like, post-independence Morocco, if you want to say that, still dealing with a lot of things, and bring these characters and really in a very direct way, I always say that this sort of unflinching depiction of things and tell us, like, literally us as readers, we really get to sort of like bond with this character, but also know what the suffering of this character. I mean, just think about it, like in the prostitution itself, right? And prostitution at that stage in Morocco, in Tangier, being something, you know, historically really something that came with sort of colonialism, having all this brothel sort of established like for, you know, Spanish soldiers and this and this and that. So Shukri really, really kind of described all of this thing, but I always feel that there's always like a political message there that would sort of indirectly so different than other writers that might have been really directly resistant and calling people to, like, you know, for lack of a better term, calls to arms. But he has his way of actually really describing the ills of society and the injustice for all other sort of characters.
And he, I mean, he knew prostitutes. He frequented prostitutes. Like he, he knew them closely. And what I think makes him a good writer is in that passage when he, you know, the narrator indulges in this philosophical turn, which is beautiful and is true. And then his wife tells him he's an idiot. And then a page later, they're hitting each other because also he's never sentimental. He's never simple. Yeah. He's never, like you say, he's not sort of like in, you know, engaging in anything that's sort of like romantic or unrealistic. And there's some humor. There's a lot of darkness. And, you know, there's this honesty that's what makes it like a great short story, as opposed to just a statement about, you know, how things are, the ills of society. Like he's something else. And to me, much more, and I'm sure to you, much, much more interesting.
I mean, you would see, like, in terms of, you know, we talked earlier about, like, his, but also it's really cool is, like, when you read all these, like, stories, you find this sort of minimalistic, like, sort of, like, prose, right? If you go back, it avoids this sort of ornamentation or a flowery language, like, you know, sort of frame language as a tool of survival and testimony, which I think really is important because when we think of all the stories that, you know, I come, for instance, to all the kind of different characters, right? This character really, like, for me, myself, they live with me because I often always sort of think of the characters that's like in a short story, thinking of Jut al-Ghariba, right? The strange corpse and all. And what I like about the just to stay sort of Tales of Tangier, all these like stories, so many characters, different characters, different city, different contexts, and dealing with so many like different topics also. I mean, I often think of the strange corpse, right? This corpse laying in the middle of nowhere, having this sort of phosphorus things coming out of the corpse and how he's describing it and how everybody's coming from all different parts of the world. I really think that, you know, all these like tales that we have in here, they have, you know, kind of different contexts, but also like I think it's so precise in its own description. And there is no, to me, it's like gritty sort of realism, right? I always say that Shukri describes things as they are without any sort of embellishment. In fact, in the Majnun al-Ward, in the introduction to it by Mohammed Birada, it's a beautiful introduction to it. And Breda is talking about how Shukri sort of describe things as really they are in society. It's not coded in anything that's away from what's actually like people really encounter in society. So it's like a direct reflection of society, direct description of what they actually undergo or what they endure on a daily basis.
And without this sort of veneer of sadness about it or pity or condescension that I think one often finds.
Absolutely. And that brings me also, Marsha, to the character of Fadi, for instance, in Faces, right? Because most of the time, people also had this sort of direct criticism of Shukri, thinking, well, you know, sort of this like, look that's so how can I even describe it? He's been described by other being misogynistic, like the way he describes like women. And in fact, sometimes they say to people, you really got to read the stories of Shukri. I mean, in fact, like the first one really in Faces, give you a good example of Love and Curses, how this sort of character that he described as being fatty from the get-go as a person that really came from the Sea of Larish because she needed to make ends meet. But also the way he describes her, she's so different than other people. She's actually educated. And I can just probably like quote something from the story that he would say, the other escort bartenders and prostitutes told vulgar and made up stories when they spoke about their past, which was also fraught with deprivation and abandonment and gossip about the lives of their customers. By contrast, fatty and rich and flirty chatter draw inspiration from the book she read voraciously. Although she did not understand much of their content, her ambition to grow and improve herself encouraged her to read every day. And this is really, to me, is important as well, sort of description of character. You have a character that he's describing here that she's well-read, though she might not understand every single thing, but you... And also when you come to Fatty, you will see the, sort of the evolving nature of Fatty in the end of Face as well when he comes back to her. But also I think this is why many times I feel like there should be like sort of a reading of Mohammed Shukri's like really narratives and his work. And this should be sort of a reevaluation, really, or lack of a better term, rehabilitation.
I love the character of Fatty. I think because he loves her. And he makes that pretty clear. And
correct.
I think what he admires in her is that maybe perhaps most of all is that she's a survivor. Like she's a smart, like clever, you know, brave, resourceful person who will do all sorts of things to get where she needs to get and absolutely. What she needs to get. And I agree. I mean, like, you know, I don't think one can... It's not necessarily a judgment on, like, you know, that there's sexual violence in a lot of his stories, but there are stories narrated by sex workers, like female sex workers. He manages to write those kinds of stories. I think these were the women he knew. He was, I think, you know, open himself about his like difficulty in having a relationship, bourgeois romantic relationship with women. I mean, he was a person who was traumatized and had like clearly demons, like all sorts of demons. I mean, that's something that's well documented by his friends, and you know that he drank a lot himself. He had like, you know, various breakdowns, and he had, you know, very difficult relationships with women. But as a writer, I think he's being honest about the kinds of relations that men and women have in the situations he's describing. And it's actually absolutely. Very complex and nuanced relation. Like they're not simply, it's not a look of simple misogyny towards the women, I would say. Yeah. Even in For Bread Alone, there's that lovely, there's that lovely girl who is one of the most charming, you know, charismatic characters in the whole book.
Absolutely.
And a real rebel who gets away, the freest of them all.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I want to just say in terms of that, really, it always brings me back to Shukri as a child. And Shukri multiple times. And one of the reasons we always people ask, why didn't he get married? But he didn't want to be like, he would say he didn't want to be like his father because he remembered the sort of the abuse and the violence for him as a child. For him as a child, actually seeing his father cursing his mother, like all these sort of like curses of vulgar language, but also being the next room and hearing the description him, like, you know, his mom is being beaten by the dad. And for him, like the father is written in the house. And you could see that. I mean, you could literally see that sort of description, and he always that sort of traumatic experience lived with him. Thinking also of him, didn't want to be the father who was so abusive to the mother in terms of violence, in terms of you know, even sexual abuse and all that. So I think that's really lived with him all his life. And you know, coming back to the character, I mean, for instance, I just give an example. You're saying, look at the way he's really describing Aisha. Look at the widow. I mean, it having sort of this character really narrating their stories. And I think that really speaks to the fact that sort of humanizing, I think, all these, sex workers, like prostitutes, that are so denigrated in society, that are so unjustly treated. And I think his narrative...
It's not like men come off well in his stories.
You see that in stories. I mean, like even Mae Moore or others by itself, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what I just always... I mean, one of the probably hard things really, and I say this, Shukri used to say, الخبز الحافي لعينتي, which is like, forbidden loan is my curse. And I think it really eclipsed all his other work. This is something that throughout his life, like in Tangier, people would call him like Sahib الخبز الحافي, sort of the owner or the writer of الخبز الحافي. And that really eclipsed all other work. Like everybody, I would say even like internationally, but also in the Arab world, people knew Shukri just by الخبز الحافي. And الخبز الحافي created this sort of scandal, which really was hard on him, because everybody has just this writer who has written about sex, who has written about violence, who has drug, who kind of mischaracterized, like, you know, the Morocco, who has all that. So Shukri, for so many people, for so many years, every time Shukri's name would come up, they think of Al-Khubz Al-Hafi. And on multiple, like, you know, talks or platforms, I would always say that this should be like sort of you need to read Mohammed Shukri. You need to read this over. You need to read. But I think a lot of people that, you know, probably did read الخبز الحافي, nothing else, or maybe not, but also this sort of scandal that has been written about in a lot of places, even till now, sometimes people just sort of like, you know, this sort of reductionist view. Well, when you think about Mohammed Shukri, you're thinking like of all this and that, because, you know, he actually like broke all these cultural taboos that nobody else actually did at that time.
Could we talk a little bit about the translation of, particularly for Bread Alone, into both English, you know, mainly into the English, but also into the French? Yeah. If you could just kind of launch us into that discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll probably like say a little bit about the encounter and go straight to the translation, because I think the encounter of Mohammed Shukri and, Paul Bowles really important to this conversation. So Mohammed Shukri was introduced to Paul Bowles by Edward Roditi. And I'll probably just set the scene. And so at that meeting, we had Edward Roditi, Peter Owen, and Paul Bowles and Mohammed Shukri. And Edward Roditi really mentioned that, you know, Mohammed Shukri, like, you know, really had the story that needed to be written. And the conversation went on, and then they've drafted the contract. Mohammed Shukri got £100, and then that's it. That was sort of the start of it. So Mohammed Shukri, in multiple interviews, said like he didn't have a script. He would go write like a page or two, and he would come to the apartment of Paul Bowles, and he would narrate the story in Spanish with some, you know, at times he would say, he would use like sometimes like a little French, you know, but more mainly Spanish. We know this, that Paul Bowles, Moroccan Arabic and Morrison Arabic was very limited. And it was literally in Spanish, and then the translation would happen. And Mohammed Shukri would say that Days did not write anything. He would just like, claim that he was sick and he wouldn't go visit. So this is sort of the start of the relationship. It was really intense because Paul Bowles in the Five Eyes, that was where he published a bunch of short stories of Mohammed Shukri, Lamrab, Tla'iyashi, and all those. In the preface, he said that, Shukri would come and say to Paul Bowles, the English text does not have a comma, does not have a period. And Paul Bowles would yell at him and say, Mohammed, this is English, not Arabic. So it was a really sort of intense, and they've both of them agreed that Mohammed Shukri should sit in a corner and Paul Bowles should sit in the other corner. And Paul Bowles said this. No, seriously, this is really, and Paul Bowles actually said this. He said, I've loved working with the illiterate, Minil Mrabt and others, because they had, and I quote here, no preposition to propound. And I hope I'm quoting, you know, accurately, but that's in terms of that. But he really, sort of, Shukri was so different for him, and he really had a hard time to work with him. Now we'll go to sort of the translation. I mean, there has been a lot of debate. And I can tell you this right now as we're having this conversation. I mean, if you are a person that look at the Arabic and the English, and this is just to say, Al-Khubz Al-Hafi for Bridlow has really attracted a lot of attention of scholars. This is the thing that has been written about a lot than anything else of Shukri. Like the Tales of Tangier, there is only Aqbib who wrote one single sort of article on the stuff I've written myself. I mean, and one of the things you would find, and just to sort of think about the English translation, there are a lot of things. This sort of political message is not there. This sort of colonial legacy, there are a lot of deletion. In fact, if we had time, I could tell you from page 9 to page 12, I can give you so many deletion from the Arabic to the English. And when I talk about deletion, really things that are super important, I can give some sort of examples in terms of that. I mean, the relationship was really fraught from the get-go between both of them. Shukri and Paul Bowles, they had a fallout for many years. And specifically because Shukri's claim and complained that he never got any sort of royalties at all from Paul Bowles. That £100, that's the only thing that he got. And when we talk about the translation, just to see some major concerns, really, I mean, some of the major concern with the Orientalist lens, some of the critique that Bowles sort of emphasized, like, you know, this sort of exotic, sordid, like sensational elements, you know, I mean, yes, there is poverty, there is sex, there is drugs, but in a way to conform to sort of Western expectation from somebody coming from, let's say, the Arab Amazigh world. I mean, that's really, you know, this sort of depiction of underbelly sort of reminiscent of the Orientalist depictions. This is really a big thing there if you make sort of a comparison. You know, the other thing also that we understand, this is sort of unusual because you guys do translation work as well. This work has been done orally. You didn't have an Arabic text in front of you to deal with. These are things that are narrated orally from Muhammad Shukri and being translated. And it's really usually, this is not the way it usually goes. I mean, it's the sort of like, quote unquote, the standard way. You have a book that's been published in Arabic, or the writer is writing and you're getting the work and you're translating the work. But this is sort of orally. And this have a lot of implications. Some people talk about the erasure of the Arabic voice, you know, having both shaped this sort of global reception of Shukri and all that. Another thing that I just sort of like, if you're thinking on here, sort of example, just to give you sort of examples, for Bridlow or Khubz Al-Hafi, I always go for Khubz Al-Hafi because it could be like naked bread, could be bare bread in sort of translation, but we're not really sort of debate what's the sort of the optimal or the right title. But you would find, you know, for instance, any sort of resistance to the colonial legacy or colonial power is sort of massage, if I could use that term, or like kind of not, that is, doesn't have a, this sort of like presence in Paul Bowles' translation. Also, even when it comes to sex. So for instance, I'll give you just an example. So in Bridlone, you have the Spanish, man, you know, with Shukri in the car. They have that sort of like, you know.
He's a young boy. He's arrived in Tangier, you know, and he's basically propositioned by a grown man who's Spanish and allows this man to perform a sex act on him. Correct. And he's like a teenager. He has nothing. He's just arrived in town, and that's the only way he can make money.
Correct. And you see the way that's in the Arabic script, and you see the way that actually being translated by Paul Bowles. So these are really, like, these are really...
So the difference,
because Shukri at times in his own writing, when he thinks of anything that has to do with homosexuality, though he sort of practiced that in his life, he would sort of dismiss it. Any sort of dismissal is actually not present in the English translation. And this is not the only one. I mean, there are like others in there. Another thing which is really important, what happened in March 30th, when you have sort of all this, the resistance against the colonial forces, right, pre-independence.
Right, there's a street protest.
Exactly, street protest. the way that the script in Arabic, and I wish we could do like page to page here, but it's entirely, you don't have this sort of urgent political message of Moroccan action resisting colonial forces. You don't really have these in the translation. And in fact, just to give you, I can give you a more sort of example, even Hanger. And I'm looking at things I've done myself, which I have so many pages comparing the Arabic and the English in terms of that. I'll give just a couple of examples. So this could be just like, so he says in Arabic, ركلني حتى تعبت رجلاه وتبلل سروالي. He goes on, he won't kick me until his leg was tired. They have an entire thing that's completely, تبلل سروالي by itself, that actually like being deleted. And there are tons. I mean, I can go through all the list. And this is what I've always like said, we only have one translation, for Khubz al-Hafi, and I really think there should be a second one. We have to have another. It's about time actually to have, translation of Khubz al-Hafi. I really believe that. I mean, we're talking from 1973. I mean, it's over 50 years.
I mean, it's a very, very interesting question because, as you say, because Paul Bowles was a literary celebrity already when this collaboration took place, like, he was, his name was on the cover, which is another thing that Mohamed Choukri was later very resentful of. Like, he has this quote where it says his name is on the cover side by side with mine, as if he wrote the book. And definitely Bowles' participation was one of the things that helped the book gain prominence. And I just think it is just a really fascinating question because Choukri both benefited and was harmed by the collaboration.
Absolutely.
Like, clearly,
Absolutely.
Both things happened. And when he writes about Bowles, his own mixed feelings about him are so clear. Like, he did write this essay about him that is very critical and that has that killer line in it that Paul Bowles loved Morocco but didn't like Moroccans.
Moroccans,
which
correct.
Is a sort of an epitaph to end all, But he also says in it, he was a good writer and I admired his writing and I think he admired mine. But that's a different conversation. I mean, there's a lot of, and then I think it's very hard not to read into that version of El Khubz al-Hafi everything that one thinks about Bowles himself and his own writing, which did clearly have Orientalist elements. And then he made many remarks, which are problematic, of sort of nostalgic for pre-independence Morocco and, always sort of enamored with the romance of a sort of kind of savage and authentic place.
Mm, absolutely.
And so one is always, I think it's like, it makes one suspicious of the book because of everything else that one knows about Bowles. And it's, but I find it fascinating because it is the sort of mystery. Like you say, we don't have, we will never quite know all the elements that went into this and into the relationship and into the process. But I think a point by point comparison of the texts would be super interesting to read. And a new translation would also be super interesting to have.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important. And one of the things I want to just say, if you have the first edition for Brilon, it came out on the front cover. It's written in the Sunday Times wrote, "Bowles understand Morocco better than most Moroccans." That's right on the front cover.
When that's first wild.
Yeah, that's in there. On the back, you'll have Paul Bowles. This is the first one. You have Paul Bowles' picture and Mohamed Choukri, Paul Bowles' top, and Mohamed Choukri at the bottom. And this is really the first one. I've always kind of carried this and show people what actually in Sunday Times, thinking that, that Paul Bowles know Morocco better than Moroccans. And the fact that actually that sort of mischaracterized, because Paul Bowles many times said he really didn't care for Morocco or Moroccans. And he many times he said he loved the international zone. He loved Tangier prior to independence because he could do whatever he wanted. For him, Tangier after independence was not appealing, was not like the Morocco that he loved. He loved Morocco pre-independence. And he actually wrote about this. But just to come back to one point, just to think of this, like the question that I always raise is to think of, as you mentioned earlier, sort of the power dynamics and translation, sort of who controls the narrative when non-Western author's work is mediated through Western translator. I mean, even we think of Iver Tarb and Jlun. And you also have the question of authenticity versus accessibility. Yes, it's really, nobody would deny that Muhammad Shukri himself, having this sort of like being a star, being famous or infamous, like it's due really to Paul Bowles, that he put him in the map. I mean, this is not sort of questionable, because if you think of others, I always think of Mohamed Zifzaf, a wonderful Moroccan writer, great, like Raconteur, look at his sort of short stories and all that. But he really didn't get the same sort of like, you know, acclaim or like fame or whatever as Mohamed Shukri, because his work really, I mean, all we have is really what has been translated by Roger Allen and then Srafi, you know. And the other thing I'm thinking about it also is, you know, I'm always thinking about sort of translation as sort of like, you know, when you think about form of cultural appropriation or mediations, that are really big questions to look at. But I'm always coming back and thinking of, you know, I always say this, and I'm, you know, we do all work, all of us translators here, but also like at times you really think, what really gets me to think of, you know, Khubz al-Hafi and think of this urgent political messages that you don't see there, or the depiction of certain things that you like, why, you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, translation is like reimagined interpretation, really how you serve, you reimagine a text and you interpret the text. It's a new work, right? You're injecting a new life to this work. I mean, I don't really like, you know, I don't like go this question sort of about like fidelity and all these kind of things, but I just feel that when you really put text to text, you really see that there are things that are in the original that have this sort of a purpose, and not all of them. I'm not going to say that's sort of missing in the translation. And I think, you know, I definitely believe that there should be second translation. Mm-hmm. When I come back to the question that was mentioned by Marsha for Tarb and Jlun, I would only narrate the incident that you know, Mohammed Brada told me himself, there was really a sort of misunderstanding and almost a fallout relationship between, you know, Tarb and Jlun and Mohammed Shukri, for what Tarb and Jlun said about Mohammed Shukri, even after being a literate, literate imagination. But Shukri was really, really mad about the comment. I believe there was if I remember very well, Le Figaro, I believe, not Le Monde, where Tarb and Jlun published a piece. Then Mohammed Brad told me he was
a
the
piece
one
in which he said something kind of condescending about Shukri.
Condescending about Mohammed Shukri. And I'm really still looking through the archive to get that specific piece. But then Mohammed Brad told me, and this is like personally told me, that he, to sort of work out this sort of, you know, misunderstanding, he suggested that Tarb and Jlun translate Mohammed Shukri's Khubz al-Hafi.
Oh,
I do mention that in a few places, but this is really coming directly to me from Mohammed Murada, who actually said, and you know, I mean, one of the things I want to say here, like I'm really trying as much to get as much from the archive, even it would be so fascinating to actually look. I mean, I do have, you know, Paul Bowles in Tangier. I do have a copy of the Shukri's actually like a manuscript, a copy of it. The same of some of faces like written in the manuscript, but I've been like asking and talking to the family just to see what kind of things we have from, you know, Al-Khubz al-Hafi, because what Shukri really narrates and what other people narrates in other work that has been written, sort of like, you know, autobiographies of Mohammed Shukri, is that Mohammed Shukri, when he was writing, he would go to a coffee shop for 2 hours. And he would be writing, you know, in a notebook what he was writing, Al-Khubz al-Hafi. It'd be fascinating to actually get a copy of that.
Oh, it'd be lovely. It'd be
fascinating. And see even the dates. Because even now, there is this sort of conversation of, you know, giving Tarb and Jlun actually like a script in Arabic. Because we know that the Arabic did not come to 1982.
Right.
The French came in 1980. And that's one of the reasons, you know, Mohammed Shukri was actually invited to La Poste Khof, with Pivot.
This is a great French literary TV talk show. Yeah, I saw the footage of that. It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing to see him on this television platform surrounded by these French writers. And he looks so proud and so sensitive at the same time. Yeah. And so like, it's really quite something. I just wanted to say one more thing about El Khobz El Hafi, which is that with all of these questions and skepticism that one may have about the elisions or the sort of whatever you want to call it, the editing that Paul Bowles did, is that I don't think that should take away from the fact that it is Mohammed Choukri's book. Like, he insisted on it, and that it is an excellent book. Like, I was surprised rereading it. I mean, I was surprised, but I wasn't sure when I went to reread it for this piece that I wrote. Like, you know, it had been a very long time, and I wondered, like, well, is the power of it sort of the story behind the story and the sort of sensational elements and stuff? And it is such a well told story, and the simplicity of it and the sort of naivete of the voice at the beginning, very gradually giving way to a sort of knowingness as he grows up. It is a really excellent book, and it may be 100% the book that he and then it may not be 100% the Arabic book, but I just mean in that sense that, like, you know, because in a way the criticism of Bowles then also undermined the idea that the somehow Choukri had let this foreigner write his book for him, or, you know, change his book. And I think that was also hurtful to him. Maybe.
No, I agree with you 100%. I mean, nothing really sort of like, not to be here, like something is sort of minimal or not at all, because as I see it again, like, really Choukri and all this fame and all this kind of things really do to Paul Bowles. Nobody would deny that at all. And I absolutely would tell you.
And to his own, own writing, and to his own story. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also the fact that you really have this, when you have all this debate and you have all like what the sort of criticism, and I think this happens to anybody, right? Because you always might have a book that come out and you may have multiplicity of translation. People might just, but my thing was saying that there need to be second translation, not sort of like minimize that sort of work by itself, but we still have a story there. But I think Tanoukhi wrote a really good piece, Rewriting Political Commitment for International Canon, Paul Bowles for Brit Lona's translation, Mohammed Choukri, or Khobz El Hafi, you know, that, And just like really also looking at sort of political commitment and looking for its discouraging political message of Choukri, and how sort of Paul Bowles really dealt with it in the translation. But you're absolutely right. I mean, yes, this is, you know, and again, I also like, I think of Paul Bowles, I also think of the publisher, right? I mean, I just read to you that saying Bowles understand Morocco better than most Moroccans.
Yes.
There are a lot of things mixed in this story, but what makes this book really unique is all of this stuff we're talking about, all of the oral narration of it. How did it happen? Lamrabt, you know, Mohammed Lamrabt, who worked, it was literally for many years. Again, he had a fallout with Paul Bowles. Lamrabt would describe, and we have a bunch of stories that are translated from, translated by Paul Bowles for Lamrabt. Mohammed Lamrabt. But Mohammed Lamrabt would also describe, like, you know, times when Mohammed Choukri come to see, Paul Bowles, and, you know, and he literally, you know, through conversations, like, he would say, well, he would kind of describe the relationship, and he would also describe the scene when the translation was happening. But I think this is really what makes it so fascinating. This is what makes it, after so many years, there are a lot of conversations people still talk about. We're like here talking about it and all that, but I think it just
and like you said, there's something irreconcilable about the power dynamic. Like,
absolutely,
Choukri seized his chance because it was the only chance he had, but he was really at a disadvantage. And also the economics of it, I mean, the fact that he didn't get paid and didn't get that is like a fundamental part of it.
I guess I have to ask, does anybody know, did Paul Bowles get royalties for this book, or did this book just make a ton of money for the publisher?
It's really hard. But I would do want to say something, which I don't really have proof for, but I mean, through what You know, these are like sort of conversation that Paul Bowles was getting money for because he really sold like so many copies, you know, even when it first came out. And remember also Peter Owen and Muhammad Shukri, not Muhammad Shukri and Paul Bowles, they really had a very close relationship. Peter Owen, the publisher, would come to Tangier, was a very good friend of the Bowles, both Jane and Paul Bowles. And this is not the only book that was published by Peter Owen. So I really don't know sort of the details. I mean, Muhammad Shukri came out and he literally talked about sort of he was robbed. And there was really like a fallout, like till before Paul Bowles, you know, died in 1999.
Yeah. We'll link, if we can, in the show notes to the piece that you mentioned that discusses some of these elisions. That would be really interesting for us to have.
Tanochi is a really cool piece, as I said, by Nirvana Tanochi. Came out in 2003, and really, really, I mean, good piece. And there are certain examples in there that really sort of look specifically at the translation. There has been Mona Sharif, there has been, but again, as I said again, really most of the scholars really kind of like looked at the Khubz al-Hafi. You don't really see much written about other works.
Well, we're going to end this episode by reading something from one of these later works. So from the third installment of his autobiography, which is also translated by you, which has a different, I would say, tone to it. I mean, he's aged. There's a sort of a softness that comes into faces that I didn't feel was there in some of the earlier writing. A looking back that's sort of touching. And this is this book you've mentioned multiple times. It has all these portraits of people in Tangier, including Fatih, the barmaid, sex worker survivor who he admires, and you are going to read us a passage from that to close out this conversation, which could go on for hours, and we would love to have that happen. Maybe we'll have to have a second installment.
Thank you so much. I'm going to read from a passage from News About Death and the Deceased. People may say that he had been resuscitated, but his death had been prolonged, once by a rumor and again by a joke. His livelihood is not enough for him to die only once. It is more than intrigue. It is more than rancor, making his death infinite. Once a passion for news about death and the deceased started at an early age. Today he has become the city's roaming historian of death. He is the first after the family to find out someone has passed away. He would scour French and Arabic newspapers for information and try very hard to sound out the Spanish ones. He'd pick up a newspaper in cafes, bars, from customers whom he'd inform about those who had died that day or the day before, and those who were dying. He did not read the obituaries to learn something new about the deceased, unless the deceased had been a writer or an artist. The death of ordinary people barely received any coverage in newspaper. He was the one who knew everything about everyone in the city, including the immigrants, from the day they were born until the day they died. Any news he had about the death of someone, whether in Tangier or another city, near or far, was refutable. He would color code the death, red for murder, white for natural causes, and black for suffocation. He would even be able to tell you if the person was good or bad. Every story included information about who the deceased was, who was not, and could have been. Each one stemmed from reality or from an embellished version of reality. The way he would tell the story and how much he would say depended on how many drinks he was offered, how good his mood was, how much courtesy he was shown, and how close his relationship with the person asking. Whether that person was interested in the secret of the deceased or in innocent information about the death. You'd basically hear as much as you wanted to know. Monsef rarely respected the saying, speak well of the dead. Especially when the dead had flaws What he had to say about the deceased, good or bad, depended on the appetite and generosity of the listener. He would start his story by saying either, poor so-and-so died, or so-and-so who died was this and that. He even had stories about the death of pets, dogs, cats, parrots, and birds, as well as of plants and inanimate objects. Every piece of news he ever told was a fact. Antonia's dog died. She cried over him until she drunkenly pissed herself at Bar-le-Grillon. There was a row of trees on the way to the private school. They were cut down to make spaces for parents to park when they would pick up their kids. The historical apparat bar will be demolished in order to construct a one-story building in its place.
I love how he moves from giving the obituaries of people to then giving the obituaries of pets and then places in the city.
Mm-hmm. And he loves pets. I want to tell you that. He had a dog called Juba. It meant everything for him in life. He also had parrots. He loved animals. He loved pets. To say that.
So. Yeah. And he loved the city. I think it's correct. Also, he's a chronicler of how the city changed. I mean, he's talking about another character in this story, but I feel like it reflects his own interests, which is always to sort of talk also about what's changed, what's gone, what's, especially in this final book where he is kind of looking back.
I mean, mm-hmm. This is the latest really he wrote. This book came out in Arabic in 2000. This is technically like 3 years before he passed away. And you're really seeing this, I mean, throughout all these, you know, chapters, vignettes that you have here, it just like all the faces he encountered. But what I love about this also, like sort of the details, like this sort of character development, just like what we're reading now about Monsef. I mean, the way he's describing Monsef's obsession with death, like really with such precision. It goes on and on. I mean, it would just deserve a passage.
Right.
It just it's spectacular.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jonas. As Ursula said, I think we could probably go on for another hour, but we'll wrap it up for today. But we're so grateful and we're all looking forward to fall 2026, which is when the next book is coming from Georgetown University Press.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an amazing pleasure to be with you on a tremendously enjoyed our conversation.
So did I. Thank you so much. And we look forward to the gift of more Mohammed Shoukry coming into English thanks to you.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Subscribe to Bulaq wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulaq Books and Instagram at Bulaq.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulaq is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOWT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit arablit.org, where you can also subscribe to the Arablit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulaq or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulaq@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.